Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Christopher Jones Cruz, and Anna Mateo. Later, Anne Ball will have this week's Science in the News report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Britain's Theresa May recently took office as the first woman prime minister since Margaret Thatcher. This week, Hillary Clinton will become the first American woman to receive the Democratic Party's nomination for president. These examples, along with others around the world, seem to indicate that women are making solid progress in global politics. But the most recent United Nations report on global women leaders concluded that much can be improved. There are currently 16 women who head governments around the world, according to the UN Entity for Gender Equality and the Empowerment of Women. While a few have stayed in office for a long time, many others only served a short time. Julie Ballington is a policy advisor on political participation for UN Women. She says although the number of women in elected positions has doubled over the past 20 years, much more can be done to keep the trend moving. Overall, the message is that progress is being made, but it's very slow. She says cultural and social norms, including gender discrimination, are holding women back from top leadership positions. Another major one is the candidate selection process of political parties and the political machinery itself, Ballington said. Women typically have less access to resources than men, and they are less connected in the circles where the fundraising takes place, and that certainly has an impact. According to the UN Women report, the percentage of women appointed to government cabinets is lower than women elected. The report also noted that more women rise to power in parliamentary systems than in direct presidential elections. One of the longest serving is German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who was elected in a parliamentary process as the country's first woman leader in 2005. Merkel grew up in communist East Germany, and her political career was launched shortly after the 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall. Merkel has been one of the most influential leaders in Europe over the past decade and was named Time Magazine's 2015 Person of the Year. The magazine praised her leadership on the Greek debt crisis and for her policy to accept tens of thousands of Syrian refugees despite much public opposition. The world now has two women leading major powers, Merkel and newly elected British Prime Minister Theresa May. It would be three if Hillary Clinton won in November. In addition, six out of the 12 candidates vying to be the next UN Secretary General are women. Personally, I see this as a turning tide, Ballington said. If you had the UN, US, UK, and Germany, headed by women, it definitely sets a new era we would be heading into in terms of high-level decision-making. It's symbolic. It shows that now women can be considered for the highest leadership position in 3 of the top 5 economies in the world. Rachel Vogelstein is the director of the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. She said the world will be closely watching the moves of May and Merkel as both their nations and Europe as a whole enter crucial times.
They're both considered to be pragmatic problem solvers and women who kind of put their heads down and get to work. And, you know, they will have an interesting relationship, particularly given that May will be presiding over Brexit negotiations at the same time that Germany will head into its 2017 election for a new government.
Merkel called May to congratulate her on becoming prime minister and to wish her success in the new job. A spokesman for Merkel said the two leaders agreed that cooperation in the spirit of proven friendly relations between both countries should be continued, including in the forthcoming negotiations on Britain's exit from the EU. Vogelstein, who also advises the Hillary Clinton campaign, said recent progress in electing women leaders globally is encouraging and does indicate an upward trend.
But we really do need to see more women at the top to accelerate the pace of change in this area. And I think having a woman at the head of the UN could really send an important signal to that effect.
One of the candidates for UN Secretary General is Helen Clark, who served as Prime Minister of New Zealand for 9 years. She is also the first woman to head the UN Development Program. Vogelstein said no matter which candidate is elected the next UN Secretary General, he or she will face major world conflicts, including the global refugee crisis, and terrorism.
There's a growing body of evidence that women's leadership is critical to sustainable conflict resolution. I hope we'll get the chance to see what a woman at the helm of the UN can do.
France could also be led by a woman if Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right National Front Party, mounts a successful challenge to François Hollande in next year's presidential election. Of course, the rise of women leaders is not new in world history, with many examples to demonstrate this. Margaret Thatcher was one of the most influential women leaders in modern times. She was Britain's first female prime minister, serving from 1979 to 1990. She was also the first woman to lead a major Western democracy. She was known as the Iron Lady for her direct language and tough negotiating skills. She ran for office during political and economic turmoil in Britain. She was elected on a platform of fighting the recession and dealing strictly with labor organizations seen as causing unrest. Other major political figures were Golda Meir of Israel and India's Indira Gandhi. Meir was Israel's fourth prime minister and the first woman to hold the post. After Israel gained independence in 1948, she was appointed ambassador to Russia and was later elected to parliament. A major challenge during Meir's 5-year tenure was handling the Arab-Israeli War of 1973, also known as the Yom Kippur War. Syrian and Egyptian forces attacked Israel. Even though Israel quickly won the conflict, Meir's government was criticized for underestimating the threat and she resigned in 1974. Indira Gandhi came from a family of politics and became the first prime minister of an independent India. She served three terms from 1966 to 1977 and was elected to a fourth, but was assassinated in 1984. In the beginning, she was popular for policies that helped the poor and transformed the country's agricultural system. But later, she became known for her authoritarian leadership. Going back to ancient times, Joan of Arc was a French peasant girl who rose to become a martyr, military leader, and saint. She believed she was acting under divine authority when at age 17 she led the French army to victory in the Battle of Orleans. In Vietnam, the Chung sisters, Chung Chek and Chung Yi, were major figures in the Vietnamese independence movement. The two women led the first national uprising against forces of China's Han Dynasty. The courage and strong leadership of the sisters have been cited by scholars as evidence of the respect and freedom given women in Vietnam compared to China and India. I'm Brian Lynn.
Islamic State terrorist group is not very effective in Southeast Asia right now. But terrorism experts warn the group could become stronger with more training and better leaders. IS followers are spread throughout Indonesia, Malaysia, and the southern Philippines. Experts say they have been influenced by IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's calls to carry out attacks. IS followers are also reportedly motivated by the group's desire to control areas of Southeast Asia as part of its caliphate, even as the group loses territory in Syria and Iraq. Police said the first IS attack in Malaysia took place in June this year. A grenade exploded outside a bar near Kuala Lumpur, injuring eight people. And in Indonesia this month, a suicide bombing was directed against police in the city of Solo. Only the bomber was killed. Both attacks took place during the holy month of Ramadan, but little was reported about them because 350 people were killed at the same time in a series of attacks in several other countries, including the United States and Turkey. The attacks in Malaysia and Indonesia were also not very effective. Experts point to the inexperience of the attackers and to the strength of the security forces. Badrul Hisham Ismail is an analyst with Iman Research, a Malaysian group that studies religion and society. He says the grenade attack in Malaysia was an example of the low level of ability of IS in the country. But he said it was also a sign of how the group is training to have a larger effect in the future. The threat level has risen because IS has shifted focus to build an Islamic State in this region, Ismail said. Sidney Jones is the director of the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict. She also noted that the IS threat, while low, has increased across Southeast Asia. One reason is that IS supporters throughout the region are starting to connect with each other. We need to be open to the possibility that both the method and the professionalism of attacks could increase, Jones said. IS recruitment in Southeast Asia has also become more aggressive. For example, in May, IS launched a website in the Malay language, which is understood throughout Malaysia and Indonesia. Brigadier General Hamidin, who uses just one name, is the Director of Prevention at Indonesia's Counterterrorism Agency. Hamidin said that in the past, officials could monitor traditional recruitment methods, such as indoctrination at Islamic study groups. But now, Hamidin says, those methods have been replaced by instant messaging and social media, which are not easy to monitor. IS has also attracted the support of existing networks of fighters in Southeast Asia. In Indonesia, militants who follow Santoso, Indonesia's most wanted militant, have said they will follow IS. And in the southern Philippines, a group best known for theft and kidnappings has also declared its allegiance to the Islamic State. The group, called Abu Sayyaf, now includes some Malaysian and Indonesian militants. In fact, IS released a video in June showing an Indonesian, a Malaysian, and a Filipino in Syria acknowledging an Abu Sayyaf leader as the head of IS in Southeast Asia. Sidney Jones says it is possible that some Abu Sayyaf members could train terrorists in Indonesia how to make bombs. Jones said, one would think there would be some thinking among Indonesian leaders in Syria about how to be more effective. The only answers are training and leadership. And the question is where they will come from. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
In American English, we have an expression, a dog is a man's best friend. A dog can also be a child's best friend, especially if that child is having difficulty reading. An organization called Reading Education Assistance Dogs, or READ, has been using dogs to help children learn to read since 1999. The idea is that sharing a book with a kind listener increases the confidence of the students. It can also increase their love of reading. Listeners include Izzy. Izzy is a cute, scruffy therapy dog and a regular visitor to Public School 57 in East Harlem, New York. Students meet him in the library, pick out a book, and sit down on the carpet. Izzy snuggles up to them and gets ready to hear a story.
I love reading to Izzy because he listens to me and he doesn't make fun of me when I make a mistake.
9-year-old Aileen Vasquez is in the third grade. Her parents are from Mexico. She is among the 15 students of Latin American descent at the school who were selected for the program. Bridget McElroy teaches English as a second language at PS 57.
All students that we worked with in the READ program were behind reading levels at the beginning of the year. Most of them have caught up to where they should have entered, if not surpassed that.
That achievement is important. Reading at grade level when kids are young is linked to how well they will do in school later. Studies show that kids who can't read as well as they should when they are 9 years old are less likely to graduate high school by the time they are 19. McElroy says she sees a great difference in Aileen and her classmates. The difference is not just in their reading levels. She also sees their increased love and excitement of reading. The teacher calls this phenomenal.
So not only do the kids have time to practice reading, what we're really seeing is that they are excited to read and they're motivated to practice even when Izzy's not here. And as a classroom teacher, that's phenomenal because, you know, there's very little I can do to convince a kid to go home and practice reading, where 20 minutes a week with Izzy is all that they need.
The READ teams from New York Therapy Animals work with 175 kids at PS 57 and 9 other schools. The popular program plans to expand to even more schools in New York City next year. I'm Ana Mateo.
Dinosaurs ruled the Earth for about 160 million years. Then they disappeared. Scientists have argued for years about what killed off the dinosaurs. Was it the huge volcanic eruption 66 million years ago in what is now India? That explosion changed the Earth's climate in a major way. Then, just 150,000 years later, a meteorite from space struck the coast of Mexico. This also caused changes to the climate. Both catastrophic events happened during what is called the Cretaceous period in Earth's history. Scientists have long debated which event caused the dinosaurs to disappear. One reason the debate continued was the failure of the scientists to find a perfect window from which to look into the past. But now, researchers say they have found a clear record of what happened. The new evidence comes from Seymour Island, an Antarctic island near the southernmost part of South America. The researchers reported their findings in Nature Communications. Sierra Peterson is a paleoclimatologist with the University of Michigan. She studies the climate from ancient times. To do that, she uses evidence from rocks and the fossilized remains of ancient creatures.
The timing of the volcano and the meteorite are quite close together.
Peterson says that with only 150,000 years separating them, physical evidence of the two events is so close together in the rock record that it is hard to tell them apart. But it is easier at the Antarctic island.
at Seymour Island, there's 40 meters separating those two events. So we can really separate the influences of each one, and that's why we can see the climatic impact of both as two separate events.
It makes sense why people thought it was one or the other, and really they were both right.
That is Andrea Dutton, a geochemist with the University of Florida. When Dutton was a student, she studied fossilized shells from Seymour Island. She examined them in an effort to understand ancient climate changes. But the results were unclear and difficult to understand. The fossils were put in storage until Peterson showed up with a new technique. It identifies the kinds of carbon molecules in a shell. These molecules depend strongly on the temperature of the water when that layer of shell was formed. What this meant is that, for the first time, scientists were able to find out the temperature record during the dinosaurs' last days. What they discovered was that things got hot, not once, but twice.
At the time when the volcanism began, we found a rapid warming spike that had not been seen before. And we also found at the boundary itself, when the meteorite hit, we also saw another warming spike.
It is what the researchers are calling a 1-2 punch. First, the dinosaurs were hit by acid rain and volcanic dust after the huge volcanic eruption. Dutton says things got a lot worse with the sudden temperature increase that followed.
Certainly these clams that we were studying and the other fauna in this system, they had experienced temperatures this warm earlier in the Cretaceous. But what happened here is the temperature increase was so fast that it was a large stress that they weren't able to adapt that quickly to the large temperature change.
Dutton says she and Peterson are not necessarily saying that the warming is what killed everything at the time, but it could have made things worse. It could have been responsible for part of the dinosaurs disappearing. After that, the creatures that survived the first warming spike suffered another blow, a huge rock from space hitting Earth. That impact also caused a jump in temperatures. So why is it important to know about how and why the dinosaurs died off so long ago? Peterson and Dutton suggest people should pay close attention to their work. They say the effects of fast climate change in the Cretaceous period are similar to what scientists are seeing now from climate change. Peterson says the volcano eruption before the meteorite increased pressure on Earth's environment. In that same way, the carbon dioxide gas emissions from human activities are affecting the environment today.
You're already seeing extinctions and certain organisms being under a lot of environmental stress, reduced habitat, things like that. All of the same things we're observing today would have been in play in the Cretaceous as well. And so, you know, I guess fingers crossed for no meteorite impact.
And so it seems we might have a lot to learn from the dinosaurs' disappearance. I'm Anne Ball.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.